Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Thank you all for coming. My lawyer friend at Alter Nano wants me to talk about this bottom thing, which is a disclaimer that if I say anything that I think we're going to do and we don't do it, you can't hold us responsible for it, so that's fine. I'm going to talk a little bit about energy and basically the crisis we're in, and I have a couple slides here that'll put some of that in perspective. Then I'm going to do sort of a batteries 101, which is what Altair is doing. We're making a new, hopefully game-changing lithium-ion battery. And then we're going to look at a couple of vehicles that people are trying to use our batteries in. This is a slide that came from Stanford. They have a global project up there that's looking at the environment and the climate and environment project. So it's Global Climate and Environment Project. And what they look here at is where the energy is coming from. And as you can see here, it's mostly solar, except for some tides and stuff down here and some stuff that's been stored over the eons, which we're using now, the coal and the oil. They talk about wind and all this. And you can get this on their website. And so it's interesting to look at sort of the magnitudes of everything that's happening. We have geothermal, we have gravitational, and then we have sun energy, which is the big one, whether it was used to store in the past, the hydrocarbons we're using now, or whether we're going to try to use it with wind and solar and photovoltaic. And there's now ocean thermal gradient. There's all these different things on energy. So it's a very exciting area to be in. So this one's available on the Stanford website if you want that one. And then the next one is the one I really like. This one's from Lawrence Livermore. It's old. It's 97 down here. But it's the same ratios, the one that they're doing now. But this was a good PDF file that I could put up here. And over here, we have all of the inputs for the energy. So down here is what we're usually talking about now. The petroleum, we get some from the United States, and we import some, and it goes through here. We have coal. We have a lot of coal. We have natural gas. Hydro, bio, nuclear, and other, you can see very, very small portions of what is going on. The part that I'm interested in from the battery standpoint is this little black line that comes down from the electrical generation line here that comes down and goes into transportation. And that's all electrical that's used in railroads, cars, all that type of thing. But what you really want to notice down here is that in transportation, this blue line that goes up here to wasted energy is 80% of the 24.9 quads that they're talking about. So 80% of the energy that is used for transportation is wasted. 5% or 20%, this 5 quads goes up here into useful energy. There's one here, which is non-fuel. That's making plastic bottles that we are now putting in landfills, so we have to figure out what to do about that. And basically, we could make ourselves energy independent a number of ways. One is to try to reduce this amount here. The other way is to raise CAFE. Electrical is up here. Nuclear, hydro, coal goes through the generation. It's distributed, and almost 10% of the electricity generated in the United States is lost through the distribution system. So there's another place that we can look at. There's all kinds of projects going on for superconductivity to reduce the distribution losses. Making more efficient transformers, making bigger copper wires, all that type of thing will help. But the big one here is the rejected energy is 51.8 and the used energy is 35. So way over half of the energy is wasted in a number of ways. So this is one of the reasons why everybody's looking at electric cars and buses and trains and all that type of thing. There is some progress being made. In 1973, we had these little squares here, which are these little pie pieces here, which is the amount of energy that's sort of renewable or clean. and that got bigger in 2004. So we're moving in the right direction. And this one's from the International Energy Group. And the nuclear went way up. 80% of the electrical generation in France is nuclear. Okay, so that's the big picture on energy. Now we're going to talk about the company I work for, Altair Nano. Altair Nano is a funny little company, nanotechnology company. It's a public company, so you can look up ALTI on the NASDAQ and see what we're doing. But it's really a startup because we're just getting into these lithium-ion batteries. It was a material science company in the last 10 years and just got into batteries a year ago or so. The thing that gives us the leg up in this whole industry is this guy, Tim Spittler. He's our chief mad scientist. He was on the front of the Wall Street Journal the other day on the 11th of January. And he invented a way to make lithium titanate oxide spinel adequate for putting into batteries. We tried to sell the powder to people, and they didn't want it, so we decided, well, heck, why don't we make the batteries, because it's such a game-changing technology. So we now are making batteries. One of the things you heard about in the past is that the battery, the lithium-ion batteries burned up. They had recalls, all the Sony batteries last couple of years. This is a picture of some tests that were done. And there was a whole bunch of problems we'll talk about with lithium-ion batteries. But as you know, your cell phone takes a long time to charge. It trickle charges overnight, and it still gets hot. And one of the reasons they have problems is that the anodes and the cathodes have intrinsic problems with film forming on them, which then is a resistor inside the battery and hampers the charging of the battery. So what do we do here at Altair Nano is we have a bunch of chemists, electrochemists. We make the titanate spinel. We put them in cells. We put them in batteries, and then we put them in cars. Our battery has a 10-time life cycle. It's a 15-year battery. It can be charged and discharged a lot of times, and we'll look at some data on that in a little bit. This thing is a Ragone plot. This is what all the battery guys look at all the time. So this is batteries 101. What we have plotted on the vertical axis here is the specific energy. What we have on the horizontal axis is the specific power. And all batteries have a limit on energy and a limit on power that you can get out of it. The analogy you can look at this is the energy is how big the gas tank is, how much energy you have stored in kilowatt hours. The power is what the horsepower is, and each of the batteries has a different characteristic. The purple one here is the typical lead-acid battery that is sort of 90% of all the batteries in the United States are now going into cars and things like that. Nickel-cadmium batteries are around. That's this blue line. Nickel metal hydride is this green line. Nickel metal hydride batteries are the ones they use in the Prius. Then we have our battery, the lithium ion battery, and then we have normal lithium ion batteries. And you can see here that the normal lithium ion battery line is higher than the one from Altair Nano, which means they can store more energy per kilogram. But we can go out here and get more power out of it. So this little circle out here is where we're trying to operate. We can get a huge amount of power out. And when we look at our competition, we look at all these batteries, but there's also the electrical component called the supercapacitor. And the supercapacitor can get huge amounts of power out, but it can't store much. So there's a spectrum of products that go from the lead acids to the nickel metal hydrides to the lithiums to the Altairs down to the supercapacitor. And all of these have different characteristics and have different sweet spots for applications, and we're going to talk a little bit about them. So this is called a Ragone plot, and this is the horsepower, and this is the how big the fuel tank is, and then everything plots on that. These lines here are the charge rate, the ability to put power in and take power out of the batteries. So you go down here and you can put in power very slowly, 10 hour, 100 hour. You can go up here and do charging in 6 minutes or 36 seconds, and it shows where the batteries lie on that. And here's the typical thing that a marketing guy puts together. It's a comparison of lead acid, nickel cadmium, nickel metal hydride, lithium ion, and then our battery out here. And you can see that the lithium ion has the highest energy density. That was how big the tank was on the previous picture. But everything else is green here for us, so even though we don't store quite as much energy, the cycle life is 500 versus 10,000. Charge time is 2 hours versus 3 minutes. Operating temperature range is minus 50 degrees to 75 degrees, where the lithium ions only go down to zero, and the nickel metal hydrides all go down to zero. And one of the things that the Prius owners are figuring out up in Minnesota is that in the winter, their car doesn't even use the electric part. It's only using the hybrid engine part because they don't have any power to put in and out when it's really cold. So these temperature ranges are very critical to designing a battery for a car that's going to work both in Minnesota and then also down in Phoenix in the summer. What else is good here? Pulse power. Pulse power talks about how fast you can put power back into the battery. And one of the things the Prius does, which is really neat, is when you put on the brake, it takes the motor, generates electricity, and puts it back into the battery. So it's regenerative braking. And it has to be able to accept whatever power is going around through the motor. So you want to have the broadest acceptance of pulse power. Memory effect. Everybody said, well, hey, you know, we've had these nickel cadmium batteries and you charge them once, and if you don't discharge them, they're all screwed up. That's pretty much gone because everybody now has no memory effect. What else do we have? Weight. The lead acid ones are heavy. The nickel metal hydrides and nickel cadmiums are moderate, and the lithium ions are pretty light for the energy stored. And so here's the big one down here. That lead acids are still cheap. The nickels are tied to the price of nickel, and if you're a commodity trader, then you know the nickel prices are going up big time, so these are now really expensive. But lithium, both for the lithium ion and the nano titanate batteries, are pretty moderate too. So there's a lot of good things we can look at for going to the next generation battery, which everybody thinks the lithium ions are. There's a bunch of companies in the business. There's one called A123, which is back in Massachusetts, which has got a lot of press lately. There's us. There's a bunch of people in both Japan and Korea and China that are working on it, because really the holy grail of making an electric car is getting the right battery. Okay, current lithium-ion batteries. The surface area impacts the diffusion rate. So what we have in there are two plates. One's graphite and one's another substance. The graphite is the problem because you have to make it very large in surface area to get the ions in and out. And so the surface area impacts the charge and discharge rates that are going into the battery. The crystal fracture and electrode poisoning in the graphite end of things, the graphite are all layers. And basically what is happening is that when the lithium ions go in there, they have to spread the graphite apart because the sizes aren't correct for just going in and out with no friction, basically. And there's a bunch of chemicals, and some of the products aren't safe. So the current lithium batteries are not going to make it. What do we do? We replace the graphite with a nanode structure electrode. We increase the surface, so there's lots of places for the ions to go on. We have a three-dimensional material rather than a two-dimensional planar material. And the battery performance is dramatically improved. Well, I've got another little picture here of a three-dimensional thing that the ions can go in any way. and we make what's called NLTO, lithium titanate oxide, and it's a stable 3D crystal. It's called spinel, and if you go into Wikipedia and put spinel in, you get there's a whole spiel on it in there, so you can talk about what this structure is, and we use it with the lithium titanate oxide. It retains the good kinetics at low temperatures. That's why on the previous charts you saw the ability to operate at minus 40, 50 C. It's stable. This stuff is stable to 700 C, but the battery isn't good to 700 C because you've got a aqueous electrolyte in there, so I'm going to change that to something more reasonable. High capacity, the voltage versus lithium. There's things wrong with the regular lithium-ion batteries. If you try to overcharge them, they start growing these dendrites out, which then short the battery out, and that was one of the reasons they think some of the batteries were recalled last year. We don't have an SEI. That's a solid electrolyte interface. That's a film that is on the graphite on the inside, which is like a resistor, so when you try to charge it, it heats it up. So when the current goes through this film, it heats the battery up, and that's why you have to slow trickle charge all the batteries. We, with the LTO, we can use an aluminum collector instead of copper, so that's a little bit of a less price in the total cost of the thing. And it reduces what the electrolyte has for side reactions inside. And what we get is we get a battery which has a great characteristic voltage curve. It has recharge performance that you can recharge at many, many cycles very, very fast. The cycle life is in the tens of thousands instead of ones of thousands, which I'll show you in a minute. It's got great power. It's got cold temperature recharge capabilities. So when you are trying to recharge it, you can do it at cold temperatures. You can't do it as effectively as you would at room temperature, but you can do it at 75% effectiveness. And you can also do high temperature recharging. So the battery has extended the capabilities from a temperature standpoint in both directions. Now, the theoretical sweet spot for regular lithium-ion batteries is here, but it's a very, very narrow window on charging, on temperature, and on specific energy. We have a much broader area here, so this shows that while we aren't as good in one specific place, we're better on a wider area of characteristics. So it's really one of the things that is interesting from a marketing standpoint is that all the battery makers make their own data sheets up and there's no standards, so they just put in the data that makes their battery look the best, which is normal. So now the standards committees will probably get on them to try to quantify the stuff, but this says, this purple area here says that if you're out in this area here, your battery's not going to be useful. Whereas if you're in the sweet spot for the lithium ion, you may get a little more power, but our battery can operate at very, very different areas in the charge and temperature ranges. Okay, this is a car that we put lithium ion batteries in. It's running around now. I drove it. The only thing wrong with it, it didn't have power steering, but they said they'll fix that. But it's fun to drive. It's like the Prius when you take off. It doesn't make any noise, and it never makes any noise because there's no engine in it to come on. So you've got the battery. You've got 150-mile range, which is very, very interesting in that it is one of the things that the California Air Resources Board wants for a rebates on certain cars. So the cars that we're doing qualify for this CARB gold standard. We'll talk a little bit more. We'll see some more pictures about that. This is what the battery pack looks like. It's got, between the drive shaft, it's got the batteries rail down low, and for an SUV or anything, you want to have the weight down low, so this is good from an automotive design. And that's the computer model of it, and that's basically one that's all built up. The drive shaft goes right through there. And they've got three or four of these running around at Phoenix Motor Cars, which is trying to bring these things out and give them to, they've got a bunch of orders from PG&E, yeah?
How many batteries are in that one frame?
There are 28 battery cells and each battery pack has 48 cells in it. So there's 28 times 48. And they're in series and parallel, and I think the voltage this runs on is 360-some volts. So there's two series and a bunch of parallel, and the whole trick on this whole thing is how do you put them in there and how do you get them balanced and all that kind of thing. And that's what a lot of companies, including ours, is struggling with now, the optimization of the charging and discharging and balancing and all that type of thing. Here was a little one that we just did for the first test vehicle, and we just had this one. This would run about 10 miles, but it showed what we could do, and that was just stuck there in the engine compartment. Here's what you were talking about. This is the battery. It has 48 cells in it, and they're 8 in parallel, 6 in series. And so 6 in series is about a 12-volt output of this thing, and this is a 1.25 kilowatt hour or 100 ampere hour type battery. It's got this electronic stuff stuck here because what you want to do is you want to measure the voltage on each of those parallel cells. And you want to do what the one thing that's hard on these electric cars is the fuel gauge. You want to know how much charge is left in there and the state of charge of the batteries. So you have to measure the state of charge of each of the cells and then add it all up. And they can either do that poorly by looking at the voltage because it's a flat curve, or they can do what's called Coulomb counting, where they count the electrons that went each way. But then they have to reset that periodically. So there's a lot of electrical engineering challenge that we're going to have here in the next couple of years on trying to optimize what's going on in these batteries. Here's a picture of the Phoenix car again. This is the SUT, Sport Utility Truck, and it's running around now, and the guys at PG&E have driven it, and they're talking about recharging stations because you can recharge it in 10 minutes. You can't do that in your house because you don't have enough power in your house to do it, but you can do it at special charge stations. But you can do it in 2 or 4 hours, depending on how much power you have available in your house, or you can go to a charge station and get 10-minute charging. Yeah, it's 33 modules. I was wrong, it wasn't 28. It's 33 modules, 35 kilowatt hours, 386 volts. This is a picture again of what the pack looks like under the car. And here's what you were talking about. There's 48 of the cells right in a row here. So this is the internal of the whole thing. And these are the two terminals here. We have that one all covered up so we don't get a short. Here's the electronics right here that is measuring the cell voltages and the temperatures in there. So we've got a monitoring system on the whole thing. And this is the module controller. So there's a bunch of electronics there that's on a second-by-second measurement looking at what's the health of each of the individual cells in the battery. Now, I'll go back to this one in 1 minute. Maybe I will. Yeah, there it is. Oops, went too far after that. This, because the Altair Nano battery doesn't have this ability to plate out lithium when it gets to an overcharged condition, we can have a simpler, although it doesn't look like it, a simpler electronic system. So we don't have to worry about the overcharging as much as other people do. And that's really good because we want to charge fast and we want to get the current through there and the power in there. So that's a good thing that we have a lot of headroom on this overcharging problem that other people have had. This is what one of the cells look like. It's got a whole bunch of flat plates inside, 48 anodes and cathodes stacked together, connected, and then this is coming out. This is an 11 ampere hour cell at 2.3 volts. So it's got 11 ampere hours in there. And that's what the first battery modules that we're using in the Phoenix car are made up of. Now we'll look at some of the data. We can say, hey, okay, can you go up? We can maintain a voltage even at 170 degrees C. Nobody wants to operate there, but it's still safe way above where other lithium-ion batteries wouldn't be able to operate. And this one shows sort of the difference between what the Prius does down here with their nickel metal hydrides, and this is what the Altair Nano batteries do up here. Now, why don't we just use Altair Nano batteries and everything? But right now, they're really expensive. They're probably 5 or 6 times what the same nickel metal hydride are. So that's one of the reasons, one of the big challenges for us is to try to get the prices down to be equivalent to the nickel metal hydride stuff. But you can see that the capability is there. Now, the other end of things, let's see if I have it, there's 4 times longer battery life. So they're saying that now if you have to replace the nickel metal hydrides in the Prius, you're going to have to pay, you know, $6,000 or $8,000 for that. Prius won't really tell you yet, and we haven't been able to solidify that number. But they guarantee them for 150,000 miles, and actually some are working longer than that. The 150,000 would be an extreme for the cold temperatures or the hot temperatures. I was in a cab up in San Francisco that the guy already had 150,000 miles on his taxi Prius, and it was still working fine. So the ends of the specifications are the ones that are going to be the problem, and things will probably last longer than people are guaranteeing them for. So that's good. But ours lasts really long time. And I don't know, when you look at it, one of the engineering management challenges that everybody has is a first cost versus a total life cycle cost. The first cost is that when you go down, you run around and you buy a car, and that's the first cost, but then you don't think about the maintenance and all that type of thing. If you buy an electric car, you're going to have a lot less maintenance. It doesn't need oil changes. The only thing you have to do is rotate the tire, supposedly, and plug it in. But if the battery lasts longer than the car, then it's sort of over-engineered, and you got to figure out what to do about that, because there's still value in it after the car has seen its useful life cycle. So that's one of the things we're trying to figure out is, because it lasts 4 times as long, it'll last 12 years, and it'll last hundreds of thousands of cycles, what do we do about that? We're also looking at the NLTO material supply. So if we make all these batteries, is there going to be enough lithium in the world? And we're lucky that there's lots of lithium in the world, a lot more than the nickel, so we think that the price of that is going to stay down. And what we're trying now is to find fleet people. We have all these guys that want to buy a car, but we're going to say, okay, we want them to really be in fleets and to look at the maintenance and look at the how much you get on the charges and discharges, so we can really do a good engineered experiment rather than having a bunch of hobbyists try to build things. But I'll talk later about a hobbyist, which has been fun for us. This is the Prius. People have put our batteries in one and done a retrofit to make it totally electric or just go further. The Prius, I think, goes 8 or 10 miles an hour on the battery and then turns on the engine, and people will put more batteries in the back and they can go 40 or so miles now and still the engine will turn on after that. So there's all kinds of upgrades you can do to the Prius, although Toyota doesn't like to do it. This is one of the Phoenix motor cars. It's a car that comes in from Korea, actually. They aren't sold in the United States, but they're sold other places in the world. And the fit and finish on them is real good. The airbags are in them. It's got a bunch of amenities, so it's a pretty good basis to try to electrify. This is another one. This is looking at the back of another one of the SUTs, sport utility trucks, they call them. Okay, this is my buddy Dennis, and he put batteries in this dragster, and he set the world record right before Christmas on an electric dragster. And he went he did the quarter mile in 8.1 seconds, and he was going 157 miles an hour at the end of the thing, and he's beating everybody with big gas engines. It turns out the electric motor has incredible torque at 0 RPM, and you can put a lot of current through the thing with our batteries, because it'll really take the batteries and put them out. So it's really interesting that we can, with an electric vehicle, beat all the old gas vehicles. Here he is burning out. Now, this isn't a fun car, too. There's another company, actually, called Tesla, which has got a lot of press. Tesla is founded by a bunch of venture capitalists up in the Bay Area, and they've got this car that'll go 0 to 60 in 3.8 seconds or something. And they solder together a whole bunch of lithium-ion batteries, and they're putting out a really, really neat car, really fast, and everybody loves to drive the thing. These guys are working with our battery. They're in UK. It's called the Lightning. And it turns out that they have four motors, one in each wheel. So they don't have to have a drive shaft or a transmission or anything. And so they've got wheel-driven stuff. This one's going to be really expensive. It's going to be 200,000 pounds, which is now about $400,000. So they're not going to sell many of them, but it's a neat way to look at the ability to really sell an electric car. And there's a whole bunch of people in Europe that are trying to make delivery vans and stuff and with the lithium-ion batteries. Microvet, Think, Go Green, there's all these people over there that are making these small delivery vans that do just small routes within a city. This is one of them. Let's see. This is another application. So we got the cars, and everybody's worried about the price and everything, but we also have an application where you can put batteries on the electrical grid and power the electrical grid when it needs to be powered and modify the load balancing of the grid. And we're putting huge battery packs together for that. We've got two megawatt power pack going together that's 600,000 kilowatt hours. And it's the size of two trailer trucks. So we're going to put that and plug that in at a electrical power station and test it and see what we can do with that. There's a whole bunch of people that want to do these things because they want to have distributed power. They don't want to have blackouts. They don't want to have sags in the line. There's people looking at regular lead-acid batteries for this. There's people who are looking at flywheels. There's people looking at compressed air. They're looking at all kinds of energy storage to help the grid out. And we're building a couple of big battery packs, and we're going to try them out in the next couple of months here to see if they're working on the grid. This is the inside of the trailer truck where they're all going to go. You can see these huge copper bus bars, because when you're putting around 2 megawatts of power, you don't want to have any high resistance connections. So these places are all the places the battery packs are going to go in. And I've got a picture of a battery pack here somewhere. That's the one of them going together, and that's what the battery pack looks like. So there's literally hundreds of these that fit in the slots in the trailer. You can see these huge bus bars where they come out. These are 50 ampere hour cells. This is cooling for it. We have forced air cooling on it because we want to keep the temperatures down because this one's supposed to have a huge high pulse power. So you want the stuff to go in and out, and you don't want the thing to get too hot. And we want to be able to operate these, and some of the peak summer loading loads are when everybody has the air conditioning on, and as a consequence, the ambient temperature is the highest when this thing is going to be needed. So we really need to have good cooling on the thing. I'm at the end. I've got more slides, but why don't we just do some questions, because I think that would be useful to see what you guys are interested in. There's a guy here with a question.
To ask a question, that way we can catch it on the video.
How does the weight of your batteries compare to like a normal lead acid or other types of batteries? Because that could be kind of important in an electrical car.
Yeah. Let's see. Let me go back to Let me get the slide sorter out here and we'll look at a battery. This chart, I think, will be good. This is sort of a look at what the energy density in watt hours per kilogram. So that's sort of the normalizing, the way you look at it. And lead acid are 30 to 40 kilowatt hours per kilogram. Kilowatt hour is what you get from the electric company. You pay about 10 to 20 cents for it, depending on when you buy it and how you buy it and all that. So the lead acid batteries have 30 to 40, and the really good soft spot, sweet spot for the lithium ion have 140, and we have 70 to 90. So we are probably 3x what it is, and the if you operate them at room temperature, the lithium ions have probably four times as much, and if you operate them at lower temperatures, they can't really operate there. See, the lead acid can go to minus 10, and the lithium ion can only go to zero. We can go to minus 50. So the weights are, we're about a third the weight per kilowatt hour stored, but we're also charged faster, we can go to lower temperatures, and we can cycle a lot more. The lead acid batteries always last, you know, 2 or 3 years in severe applications, and we can go to 12 years, we think. There's a question over there, or?
So I was wondering how much it costs to charge that car that you guys had that goes 150 miles.
Yeah, if you pay 10 cents a kilowatt hour and you have 35 kilowatt hours stored in the pack, it's $3.50 for 150 miles. So we're real cheap from that standpoint.
How much does the what you'd have to do at home to install that system to charge it for like 4 or 6 hours?
It's not much at all. If you have if you want to charge in 4 hours, you can just put it in a plug that's for a dryer, a 230-volt, 20 or 30-amp service. If you want to charge in a 110-volt service, it'll take twice as long on a 20-amp or 15-amps. But you can do it at home easily overnight. And one of the things, the reason the electric companies are interested in this is because they don't have anything to do with their electricity at night. So they're looking at doing what's called load leveling, where they can get you a different rate at night. If you want to charge your car, you can get it for, you know, 8 cents a kilowatt hour instead of 12 cents a kilowatt hour. So it even costs you less to do the charging at night. And they can keep all their plants just running at a steady rate, which is the most efficient way to run an electrical plant.
Are there any concerns about driving the electric car in the rain, like as far as water and touching the batteries?
They have some safety criteria that's already been specified by SAE, the Society of Automotive Engineers, and the Prius has all these colored cables inside. They're worried about not as much in the rain because that's more or less okay, but if there's a fire or something in the car, the firefighters don't want to get electrocuted by the stuff because there is high voltages inside. They're going to be running at 300 to 400 volts. So they're all color-coded, and they're all essentially put in raceways where it's not going to be a problem. But we always wondered, well, what if somebody drives it into a pond, what happens? So that's always an interesting, what do you do about that? And it's going to be how much engineering do you have to put in to assure that the dummies aren't going to do something dumb? Yeah, I know they will. You can't do it.
Yeah, I'm over here. Can you quantify roughly how much of the cost differential is due to the fundamental technology and how much is just a scale issue?
For us?
Yeah.
The fundamental technology, there are people making lithium-ion batteries now that they're getting, you know, the lowest prices I've heard are like 30 cents a watt hour. We're now sort of at $2 a watt hour, and we think that there's no reason we can't come down to the 50 to 30 cent range if we can really get the volume up. It's got everything in it is exactly the same as an A123 battery or somebody like that who have already done some very good work on cost and safety. They've changed the cathode. We're changing the anode. And the only thing difference in ours from the A123 type thing is that we've eliminated the graphitic anode and we put in our lithium titanate oxide. And it doesn't cost that much more than the graphite. So from a basic material standpoint, it's going to be about the same. And we're just in very low volume production. We're about 2 years behind everybody else because for a while we were trying to sell this lithium titanate oxide to people, and they really didn't want it. They didn't see the advantages of it because everybody was trying to get this number to be the highest. The energy density was the holy grail to try to store more energy per kilogram for the cars. But now they're seeing that there's some other things. The cycle life, if you've only got 500 to 750 cycles on the thing, that's sort of 2 years if you do it every day. But we've got 10,000 plus. So if you do the total life cycle cost versus the first cost, which is one of the educational things we're going to have to get the consumer to know, but that's one of the reasons why governmental people were looking at a lot of putting a lot of these things in buses. We're looking at putting a lot of these into fleets and that type of thing, and they look at total life cycle cost as opposed to first cost. So that's a good point.
Hi. I was wondering a little bit about the history of this project specifically, because, you know, as an OEM provider of, you know, a disruptive battery technology for new cars.
Right.
And you said one of the channels also was, you know, looking at buses, major transportation, where it might make more sense to take that fixed upfront cost. And kind of getting to what someone was saying back there as far as the scalability issue. Because, you know, right now you said $4,200 or something for a battery. And I'm thinking, wow, you know, all these things are great. But if you guys are able to get a major contract, do you see those costs going way down as far as material costs, as far as, you know, like what he was saying about the technology that's actually embedded within the battery, you know, to where obviously it's disruptive, but it also can be price competitive.
Right. See, that's the whole point. How do we get the volume up? It's the chicken and the egg, which comes first. And the thing, we think we have this disruptive technology, and this is one of the things that you'll, when you're trying to manage technology, this is one of the things that's really a key. We could go to somebody like GM or Ford or Chrysler or Toyota, but they say, okay, if we take this technology, then we want you to give that technology so we can have a second source. So it's a balance of, do we want to have a monopolistic position in the batteries, even at a low volume, or do we want to say, okay, we're going to license the technology to somebody else? And we haven't made enough to really know how strong our position from this chart is yet. You know, I can say, hey, these things are great. Look at all the green things here. But we don't know. We're just feeling our way into the marketplace, into a number of different marketplaces now. The stationary power market. We've also got another project, which is really interesting, from the Navy. The Navy has these ships out there, and they have three turbine generators that are on. One is on doing power for the boat, for the ship. Another one is standing there, just spinning, called spinning reserve. It's doing nothing, all wasting energy. $2 million worth of diesel fuel per ship per year. And they just say, hey, if the first one goes down, we need the thing to be up. But if we put a battery system in there, then they've got a third one over there, which is the third backup. So we can put a battery system in that'll be the intermediate backup. So there's, and we can go on in a half a cycle with the new electronics that are available. So that we've got a contract with them to try to see, okay, can we do something with the surface ships that will enable them to stop wasting $2 million of fuel per year per ship and get rid of one whole generator system.
Has it been a hard value proposition to sell?
Their research people, they came to us. You know, so it's not, we got a bunch of market pool for the technology. It's just not from the car companies, but the car companies are the ones that have all the visibility because it's huge. You know, it's billions and billions as opposed to millions and millions. So it's interesting that the technology has bred a lot of people that say, hey, I got this great thing for that. There's flywheel guys out there that are putting standby generators out on Long Island next to the Long Island Railroad where the train can't start up because there's too much voltage drop going down the catenary. So what are they doing? They're saying, hey, we want to put a flywheel or a battery system right next to the station and get the power from it. So there's all these funny little applications that people are breaking down our door, and we say, okay, well, which one do you do? And that's an interesting thing from a technology standpoint. How do you manage that whole thing? And that's one of the things that I'm involved with there to try to figure that out. There's somebody back there.
Yeah. What do you think about eStore and the ultracapacitor
model for distributing.
Yeah, eStore is really interesting. I hope they work, because it'd be fantastic to be able
to
do that.
With Lockheed Martin.
The little bit of information that's out there in the marketplace, if they can do the thing at 3,000 volts and store what they think they can store, then we're going to be out of business. But that'd be good for everybody, probably. We have enough other stuff we can do. But that if they can do what they think they can do, it'd be great. Now, they're using barium titanate ceramics, and there's a whole bunch of people that are worried about the dielectric strength there at these voltages in the barium titanate ceramics. And it depends on the quality and the cleanliness and the single crystal ability and how they make the thing. So if they have a breakthrough on a manufacturing process, it's going to be really good. If they made one out of 100 and they just happen to have one work, it's a different thing. But they have to get the manufacturing process, and that'd be really good. There's a car company, I think, up in Canada that is supposedly waiting for some to put in their first cars. But there are artificial capacitors. There's some buses in Europe that are running around, just short-range buses that are using ultracapacitors. The other thing is the ultracapacitor may be a really good thing for us. Because it could, let's see where my chart was on the, yeah, this one. Because this is back where the really sweet spots are. So if you really want to get a lot of power out real fast, you put an ultracapacitor in. So there might be a marriage of ultracapacitors, our technology, or one of the other technologies where they could trade off and you could get the power you need to start up or something and then have the moderated power for a longer period of time from a battery system or a flywheel or compressed air or something like that. So I hope eStore gets the thing together and gets them out there. It would be a really good technology to have.
You're talking about that car that goes 150 miles before it dies out?
Yeah.
How much would one of those cost and how fast can it go?
The one that we're making now has a spec that it goes 95 miles an hour on the freeway. It costs, the question of the cost is a really interesting thing, because the Phoenix motor car guys, and you can look at their website, they have pictures of all the stuff on there and everything. They are trying to get a subsidy from the California Air Resources Board, who has had this thing in place for 15 years now. And I'm not an expert on it, but what it is they were trying to get everybody to make fuel cell cars or hybrids or things like that, and they had gold, silver, and bronze-type ratings where you could get credits back from supposedly, I think it's the car companies, who weren't supplying California with the number of environmentally friendly cars as they said they would. So they put a gold standard one out there. The gold standard said that you had to go over 100 miles, you had to recharge the thing in less than 10 minutes. And what they had in their mind at the time in the 90s when they were putting this out was the fuel cell, because you just drive up and you put hydrogen in and then the fuel cell works. But what we did was we made a battery that could be charged in 10 minutes. Nobody thought they could have that. So now we're trying to say that we qualify for this gold standard, which gets 40 credits or something, and each credit's worth $2,500, so you get $100,000 back. And so we're trying to fund some of the stuff that's going on at Phoenix with that, but whether that happens or not, the car companies are still against it, and they sued California for it and all this stuff in the past. So it's interesting. They should be hoping that somebody can do this stuff, and the California Resource Board should just stick with their guns and say, hey, this is what we said back there. We were trying to generate new technology, and it happened. So they should get rewarded for it. So anyway, that's sort of the cost. Now, the cost, you're asking about the cost. Phoenix said they were going to sell the cars for $45,000, but they cost a lot more than that right now until we get the battery cost down, because the battery costs more than that probably, depending on what the volumes are and everything. So it's an interesting balance of the government, society, and the use of the consumers on trying to adopt these electric vehicles.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.